The Third Eye by Tuesday Lovesang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 12, Herbs and Kites. The weeks flew by. There was so much to do, to learn and to plan. Now I could delve far more deeply into occult matters and receive special training. One day in early August, my guide said, "This year we will go with the herb gatherers. You will gain much useful knowledge of herbs in their natural state, and we will introduce you to real kite flying." For 2 weeks, everyone was busy. Leather bags had to be made and the old ones cleaned. Tents had to be overhauled and the animals carefully examined to see that they were fit and able to undergo the long trip. Our party was to be 200 monks, and we would make our base at the old lamasery of Tra Yerpa, and send out parties every day to search the neighborhood for herbs. At the end of August, we set out amid much shouting and noise. Those who were to remain behind clustered around the walls, envious of the ones going to holiday and adventure. As a lama, I now rode a white horse. A few of us were going to press on with the minimum of equipment so that we could have several days at Tra Yerpa before the others arrived. Our horses would travel 15 to 20 miles a day, but the yaks rarely exceeded 8 to 10 miles a day. We were lightly loaded as we took the minimum of equipment, preferring to arrive quickly. The yak train, which followed more slowly, had each animal carrying the usual 170-pound load. The 27 of us who were the advance party were glad indeed to arrive at the lamasery several days later. The road had been a difficult one, and I, for one, was not at all fond of horse riding. By now, I could stay on even when the horse galloped, but there my prowess ended. Never could I stand on a saddle as some of the others did. I sat and clung, and if it was not graceful, at least it was safe. We had been sighted approaching up the mountainside, and the monks who lived there permanently prepared huge quantities of buttered tea, sampa, and vegetables. It was not entirely unselfish of them. They were anxious to have all the news of Lhasa and to receive the customary gifts which we brought. Up on the flat roof of the temple building, braziers of incense threw dense columns of smoke into the air. Up into the courtyard we rode, with newfound energy at the thought of the end of the journey. Most of the other lamas had old friends to meet. Everyone seemed to know the Lama Mingyar Dondup. He was swept from my sight by the welcoming throng, and I thought that once again I was all alone in the world. But after only a very few minutes, I heard, "Lhasang, Lhasang, where are you?" I soon answered, and before I knew what was happening, the crowd had opened and more or less engulfed me. My guide was talking to an elderly abbot who turned and said, "So this is he? Well, 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 and so young, too." My main concern, as usual, was food, and without wasting more time, everyone moved in the direction of the refectory, where we sat and ate in silence as if we were still at Chakpori. There was some doubt as to whether Chakpori was a branch of Tra-Yerpa, or the other way about. Certainly, both lamassaries were amongst the oldest in Tibet. Tra-Yerpa was famed as having some really valuable manuscripts dealing with the herbal cures, and I was going to be able to read them and make all the notes I needed. There was also a report on the first expedition to the Chang Tang Highlands, written by the 10 men who did that strange journey. But of greatest interest to me at the present time was the level tableland just near, from which we were going to launch our kites. The land here was strange. Immense peaks jutted out of continually rising ground. Flat tablelands, like terraced gardens, extended from their foot of peaks, like broad steps reaching higher and higher. Some of these lower steps were rich in herbs. One form of moss found here had far greater absorptive powers than sphagnum moss. A small plant bearing yellow berries had amazing pain-deadening properties. The monks and boys would gather these herbs and lay them out to dry. I, as a lama, would now be able to supervise them, but for me, this trip would consist mainly of practical instruction from the lama Mingyar Dondup and herb specialists. At the present moment, as I looked around, the only thought in my mind was kites, man-lifting kites. Tucked away in the lamassary building behind me were bars of spruce which had been brought from a far country, for no such trees grew in Tibet, and spruce, probably from Assam, was considered as ideal for kite construction, as it would take hard knocks without fracturing, and it was light and strong. After the kites were finished with, the wood would be examined and placed into store, ready for the next time. The discipline was not greatly relaxed here. We still had our midnight service, and the others at regular intervals. This, if one thought about it, was the wisest way, as it would be harder to observe our long hours later if we relaxed now. The whole of our class time was devoted to herb gathering and kite flying. Here in this lamassary, clinging to the side of a mountain, we were still in daylight, while down below the ground was clothed in purple shadows, and the night wind could be heard rustling through the scant vegetation. The sun sank beneath the far mountain peaks, and we too were in darkness. Below us, the country looked like a black lake. Nowhere was there a glimmer of light. Nowhere, so far as the eye could range, was there a living creature, except here in this group of holy buildings. With the going down of the sun, the night wind rose and set about the business of the gods, the dusting of the corners of the earth. As it swept along the valley below, it was trapped by the mountainside and was channeled up through the faults in the rock to emerge into our upper air with a dull, moaning boom, like a giant conch calling one to service. Around us there was the creaking and crackling of rocks moving and contracting now that the great heat of the day had gone. Above us the stars were vivid in the dark night sky. The old people used to say that Kesar's legions had dropped their spears on the floor of heaven at the call of Buddha, and the stars were but the reflections of the lights of the heavenly room shining through the holes. Suddenly, a new sound was heard above the noise of the rising wind, the temple trumpets sounding the close of yet another day. Up on the roof, as I looked, I could dimly discern the silhouettes of monks, their robes fluttering in the breeze as they carried out their priestly office. For us, the trumpet's call meant bedtime until midnight. Dotted around the halls and the temples were little groups of monks discussing the affairs of Lhasa and of the world beyond. Discussing our beloved Dalai Lama, the greatest incarnation of any Dalai Lama. At the sound of the close of day, they slowly dispersed and went their separate ways to bed. Gradually, the living sounds of the Lamasery ceased, and there was the atmosphere of peace. I lay on my back, gazing up through a small window. For this night, I was too interested to sleep, or to want to sleep. The stars above, and my whole life ahead, so much of it I knew, those things which had been predicted, so much had not been said, the predictions about Tibet, why did we have to be invaded? What had we done, a peaceful, loving country with no ambitions other than to develop spiritually? Why did other nations covet our land? We desired nothing but that which was ours. Why, then, did other people want to conquer and enslave us? All we wanted was to be left alone, to follow our own way of life. And I was expected to go among those who later would invade us, heal their sick, help their wounded, in a war which had not yet even started? I knew the predictions, knew the incidents and highlights, yet I had to go on like a yak upon the trail, knowing all the stops and halting places, knowing where the grazing was bad, yet having to plod on to a known destination. But maybe a yak coming over the ridge of reverential prostration thought it worthwhile when the first sight of the holy city was. The booming of the temple drums woke me with a start. I did not even know that I had been asleep. With an unpriestly thought in my mind, I tottered to my feet, reaching with sleep-numbed hands for an elusive robe. Midnight! I shall never stay awake. Hope I don't fall over the steps. Oh, how cold this place is! 253 rules to obey as a Lama? Well, there is one of them broken, for I did excel myself with the violence of my thoughts in being so abruptly awakened. Out I stumbled to join those others, also in a daze, who had arrived that day. Into the temple we went to join in the chant and counter-chant of the service. It has been asked, well, if you knew all the pitfalls and hardships which had been predicted, why could you not avoid them? Well, the most obvious answer to that is, if I could have avoided the predictions, then the mere fact of avoidance would have proven them false. Predictions are probabilities. They do not mean that man has no free will, far from it. A man may want to go from Darjeeling to Washington. He knows his starting point and his destination. If he takes the trouble to consult a map, he will see certain places through which he would ordinarily pass to reach his destination. While it is possible to avoid the certain places, it is not always wise to do so. The journey may be longer or more expensive as a result. Similarly, one may motor from London to Inverness. The wise driver consults a map and has a route itinerary from one of the motoring organizations. In so doing, the driver can avoid bad roads, or, where he cannot avoid rough surfaces, he can be prepared and can drive more slowly. So with predictions. It does not always pay to take the soft and easy way. As a Buddhist, I believe in reincarnation. I believe that we come to Earth to learn. When one is at school, it all seems very hard and bitter. The lessons, history, geography, arithmetic, whatever they may be, are dull, unnecessary, and pointless. So it appears to us at school. When we leave, we may possibly sigh for the good old school. We may be so proud of it that we wear a badge, a tie, or even a distinctive color on a monk's robe. So, with life, it is hard, bitter, and the lessons we have to learn are designed to try us and no one else. But when we leave school of this earth, perhaps we wear our school badge with pride. Certainly I hope to wear my halo with a jaunty air later. Shocked? No Buddhist would be. Dying is merely leaving our old empty case and being reborn into a better world. With the morning light, we were up and anxious to explore. The older men were wanting to meet those they had missed the night before. I wanted, more than anything, to see these huge man-lifting kites that I had heard so much about. First, we had to be shown over the lamasery so that we should know our way about. Up on the high roof, we looked about at the towering peaks and gazed down at the fearsome ravines. Far away, I could see a turgid stream of yellow, laden with waterborne clay. Nearer, the streams were the blue of the sky and rippling. In quiet moments, I could hear the happy tinkling of a little brook behind us as it made its swift way down the mountainside, eager to be off and join the tumbling waters of other rivers which, in India, would become the mighty Brahmaputra River, later to join the sacred Ganges and flow into the Bay of Bengal. The sun was rising above the mountains, and the chill of the air fast vanished. Far away, we could see a lone vulture swooping in search of a morning meal. By my side, a respectful lama pointed out features of interest. Respectful, because I was a ward of the well-loved Mingyar Dondup, and respectful, too, because I had the third eye and was a proved incarnation, or Trulku, as we termed it. It may possibly interest some to give brief details of recognizing an incarnation. The parents of a boy may, from his behavior, think that he has more knowledge than usual, or is in possession of certain memories which cannot be explained by normal means. The parents will approach the abbot of a local lamasery to appoint a commission to examine the boy. Preliminary pre-life horoscopes are made, and the boy is physically examined for certain signs on his body. He should, for example, have certain peculiar marks on the hands, on the shoulder blades, and on the legs. If these signs are to be seen, search is made for some clue as to who the boy was in his previous life. It may be that a group of lamas can recognize him, as in my case, and in such event, some of his last life possessions will be available. These are produced, together with others which are in appearance identical, and the boy has to recognize all the articles, perhaps 9, which were his in a previous life. He should be able to do this when he is 3 years of age. At 3 years of age, a boy is considered to be too young to be influenced by his parents' previous description of the articles. If the boy is younger, so much the better. Actually, it does not matter in the least if parents do try to tell the boy how to act. They are not present during the time of choosing, and the boy has to pick perhaps 9 articles from possibly 30. 2 wrongly selected make a failure. If the boy is successful, then he is brought up as a previous incarnation, and his education is forced. At his 7th birthday, predictions of his future are read, and at that age he is deemed well able to understand everything said and implied. From my own experience, I know that he does understand. The respectful lama at my side no doubt had all this in mind as he pointed out the features of the district. Over there, to the right of the waterfall, was a very suitable place for gathering Nual mid Tangier, the juice of which is used to remove corns and warts and to alleviate dropsy and jaundice. Over there, in that little lake, one could gather Polygorum hydropiper, a weed with drooping spikes and pink flowers, which grows under water. We use the leaves for curing rheumatic pains and for relief of cholera. Here we gathered the ordinary type of herbs. Only the highlands would supply the rare plants. Some people are interested in herbs, so here are some of the details of some of our more common types and the uses to which we put them. The English names, if any, are quite unknown to me, so I will give the Latin names. Allium sativum is a very good antiseptic. It is also much used for asthma and other chest complaints. Another good antiseptic, used in small doses only, is Balsamodendron myrrha. This was used particularly for the gums and mucous membranes. Taken internally, it allays hysteria. A tall plant with cream-colored flowers had a juice which thoroughly discouraged insects from biting. The Latin name for the plant is Buconia cordata. Perhaps the insects knew that, and it was the name which frightened them off. We also had a plant which was used to dilate the pupils of the eye. Ephedra cinica has an action similar to atropine, and it is also very useful in cases of low blood pressure, besides being one of the greatest cures in Tibet for asthma. We use the dried and powdered branches and roots. Cholera often was unpleasant to the patient and doctor because of the odor of ulcerated surfaces. Ligusticum levisticum killed all odor. A special note for the ladies. The Chinese use the petals of hibiscus Rosa sinensis to blacken both eyebrows and shoe leather. We use a lotion made from the boiled leaves to cool the body of feverish patients. Again, for the ladies, Lilium tigrinum really cures ovarian neuralgia, while Flacortia indica provides leaves which assist women to overcome most others of their peculiar complaints. In the sumac rus group, the vernicifera provides the Chinese and Japanese with Chinese lacquer. We use the glabra for the relief of diabetes, while the aromatica is of help in the cases of skin disease, urinary complaints, and cystitis. Another really powerful astringent for use in bladder ulcerations was made from the leaves of Arctostaphylos uva ursi. The Chinese prefer Begonia grandiflora, from the flowers of which they make an astringent for general use. In later years, in prison camps, I found that Polygonum bistorta was a very useful plant indeed in treating cases of chromatic dysentery, for which we used it in Tibet. Ladies who had loved unwisely, but well, often made use of the astringent prepared from Polygonum erectum, a very useful method of securing abortion. For others who had been burned, we could apply a new skin. Cisbeckia orientalis is a tall plant, some 4 feet high. The flowers are yellow. The juice, applied to wounds and burns, forms a new skin in much the same way as collodion. Taken internally, the juice had an action similar to chamomile. We used to coagulate the blood of wounds with Piper augustifolium. The underside of the heart-shaped leaves is most efficient for the purpose. All these are very common herbs. Most of the others have no Latin names, because they are not known to the Western world, which bestows these designations. I mention them here merely to indicate that we had some knowledge of herbal medicine. From our vantage point, looking out over the countryside, we could see on this bright sunlit day the valleys and sheltered places where all these plants grew. Farther out, as we gazed beyond this small area, we could see the land becoming more and more desolate. I was told that the other side of the peak, upon whose side the Lamassery nestled, was truly an arid region. All this I should be able to see for myself when later in the week I soared high above in a man-lifting kite. Later in the morning, the Lama Mingyar Dondup called for me and said, "Come along, Lobsang. We will go with the others who are about to inspect the kite-launching site. This should be your big day." It needed no further remarks to get me on my feet, eager to be off. Down at the main entrance, a group of red-robed monks waited for us, and together we walked down the steps and along the drafty tableland. There was not much vegetation up here. The ground was of beaten earth over a solid rock shelf. A few sparse bushes clung to the side of the rock as if afraid of sliding over the edge and down into the ravine below. Up above us, on the roof of the Lamassery, prayer flags were held stiff and rigid by the wind. Every now and then, the masts creaked and groaned with the strain, as they had done for ages past, and held. Nearby, a small novice idly scuffed the earth with his boot, and the force of the breeze whipped away the dust like a puff of smoke. We walked towards one rocky edge of the long tableland, the edge from which the peak soared up in a gentle slope. Our robes were pressed tight against our backs and billowed out in front, pushing us, making it difficult not to break into a run. About 20 or 30 feet from the edge was a crevice in the ground. From it, the wind shot with gale force, sometimes projecting small stones and bits of lichen into the air like speeding arrows. Wind, sweeping along the valley far below, was trapped by the rock formations, and piling up with no easier mode of exit, poured up at a high pressure through the fault in the rock, finally to emerge at the tableland with a shriek of power at being free again. Sometimes, during the season of gales, we were told, the noise was like the roaring of demons escaping from the deepest pit and ravening for victims. Wind surging and gusting in the ravine far below altered the pressure in the fault, and the note rose and fell accordingly. But now, on this morning, the current of air was constant. I could well believe the tales that were told of small boys walking into the blast and being blown straight off their feet up into the air, to fall perhaps 2,000 feet down to the rocks at the base of the crevice. It was a very useful spot from which to launch a kite, though, because the force was such that a kite would be able to rise straight up. We were shown this with small kites similar to those I used to fly when I was a small boy at home. It was most surprising to hold the string and find one's arm lifted strongly by even the smallest toy kite. We were led along the whole rocky shelf, and the very experienced man with us pointed out dangers to avoid, peaks which were known to have a treacherous downdraft of air, or those which seemed to attract one sideways. We were told that each monk who flew must carry a stone with him, to which was attached a silk kata inscribed with prayers to the gods of the air to bless this, a newcomer, to their domain. This stone had to be cast to the winds when one was of sufficient height. Then the gods of the winds would read the prayer as the cloth unrolled and streamed out, and, so it was hoped, they would protect the kite rider from all harm. Back in the lamasery, there was much scurrying about as we carried out the materials with which to assemble the kites. Everything was carefully inspected. The spruce wood poles were examined inch by inch to make sure that they were free from flaws or other damage. The silk with which the kites were to be covered was unrolled upon a smooth, clean floor. Monks on hands and knees crept about in order to carefully test and view every square foot. With the examiners satisfied, the framework was lashed into position and little retaining wedges rammed home. This kite was of box form, about 8 feet square and about 10 feet long. Wings extended 8 or 9 feet from the two horizontal sides. Beneath the tips, there had to be fixed bamboo half hoops to act as skids and to protect the wings when taking off and landing. At the floor of the kite, which was strengthened, there was a long bamboo skid which tapered upwards like our Tibetan boots. This particular pole was as thick as my wrist and was strutted so that even when the kite was at rest, there was no ground touching the silk, the skid and wing protectors preventing it. I was not at all happy at first sight of the rope of yak hair. It looked flimsy. A V of it was fastened to the wing roots and reached to just in front of the skid. Two monks picked up the kite and carried it to the end of the flat tableland. It was quite a struggle lifting it over the updraft of air, and many monks had to hold it and carry it across. First, there was to be a trial. For this, we were going to hold the rope and pull instead of using horses. A party of monks held the rope, and the kite master watched carefully. At his signal, they ran as fast as they could, dragging the kite with them. It hit the airstream from the fissure in the rock, and up into the air it leapt, like a huge bird. The monks handling the rope were very experienced, and they soon paid out rope so that the kite could rise higher and higher. They held the line firmly, and one monk, tucking his robe around his waist, climbed the rope for about 10 feet to test the lifting power. Another followed him, and the two moved up so that a third man could try. The airlift was enough to support 2 grown men and 1 boy, but not quite enough for 3 men. This was not good enough for the kite master, so the monks hauled in the rope, making very sure that the kite avoided the rising air currents. We all moved from the landing area, except for the monks on the rope, and 2 more to steady the kite as it landed. Down it came, seemingly reluctant to come to earth after having the freedom of the skies. With a soft shh, it slid to a standstill with the 2 monks holding the wingtips. Under the instruction of the kite master, we tightened the silk everywhere, driving little wooden wedges into the split poles to hold it firmly. The wings were taken off and replaced at a somewhat different angle, and the kite was tried again. This time it supported 3 grown men with ease, and almost lifted the small boy as well. The kite master said that it was satisfactory, and now we could try the kite with a man-weight stone attached. Once again, the crowd of monks struggled to hold down the kite as it went across the updraft. Once again, monks pulled on the rope, and up into the air jumped kite and stone. The air was turbulent, and the kite bobbed and swayed. It did queer things to my stomach as I watched and thought of being up there. The kite was brought down and carried across to the starting point, and an experienced lama spoke to me. "I will go up first. Then it will be your turn. Watch me carefully." He led me to the skid. "Observe how I put my feet here on this wood. Link both arms over this crossbar behind you. When you are airborne, step down into the V and sit on this thickened part of the rope. As you land, when you are about 8 to 10 feet in the air, jump. It is the safest way. Now I will fly, and you can watch." This time the horses had been hitched to the rope. As the llama gave the signal, the horses were urged forward at a gallop. The kite slid forward, hit the updraft, and leapt into the air. When it was 100 feet above us and 2,000 or 3,000 feet above the rocks below, the llama slid down the rope to the V, where he sat swaying. Higher and higher he went, a group of monks pulling on the rope and paying it out so that the height could be gained. Then the llama above kicked hard on the rope as a signal, and the men began hauling in. Gradually it came lower and lower, swaying and twisting as kites will. 20 feet, 10 feet, and the llama was hanging by his hands. He let go, and as he hit ground, he turned a somersault and so regained his feet. Dusting his robe with his hands, he turned to me and said, "Now it is your turn, Lobsang. Show us what you can do." Now that the time had arrived, I really did not think so much of kite flying. Stupid idea, I thought. Dangerous. What a way to end a promising career. This is where I go back to prayers and herbs. But then I consoled myself, but only very slightly, by thoughts of the predictions in my case. If I was killed, the astrologers would be wrong, and they were never that wrong. The kite was now back at the starting point, and I walked towards it with legs that were not as steady as I wished. To tell the truth, they were not steady at all. Nor did my voice carry the ring of conviction as I stood up on the skid, linked my arms behind the bar I could only just reach, and said, "I'm ready." Never had I been more unready. Time seemed to stand still. The rope tightened with agonizing slowness as the horses galloped forward. A faint tremor through the framework, and suddenly a sickening lurch which almost threw me off. My last moment on earth, I thought, so I closed my eyes as there was no point in looking anymore. Horrible swayings and bobbings did unpleasant things to my stomach. Ah, a bad takeoff into the astral, I thought. So I cautiously opened my eyes. Shock made me close them again. I was 100 feet or more in the air. Renewed protests from my stomach made me fear imminent gastric disturbance. So I once again opened my eyes to be sure of my exact location in case of need. With my eyes open, the view was so superb that I forgot my distress and have never suffered from it since. The kite was bobbing and tipping, swaying and rising even higher. Far away over the brow of the mountain, I could see the khaki earth fissured with the unhealing wounds of time. Nearer, there were the mountain ranges bearing the gaping scars of rock falls, some half hidden by the kindly lichen. Far, far away, the late sunlight was touching a distant lake and turning the waters to liquid gold. Above me, the graceful bob and curtsy of the wind on the vagrant wind eddies made me think of the gods at play in the heavens, while we poor, earth-bound mortals had to scrabble and struggle to stay alive so that we could learn our lessons and finally depart in peace. A violent heave and lurch made me think I had left my stomach hanging on the peak. I looked down for the first time. little red-brown dots were monks. They were growing larger. I was being hauled down. A few thousand feet lower, the little stream in the ravine went bubbling on its way. I had been, for the first time, 1,000 feet or more above the earth. The little stream was even more important. It would continue and grow and eventually help to swell the Bay of Bengal miles and miles away. Pilgrims would drink of its sacred waters, but now I soared above its birthplace and felt as one with the gods. Now the kite was swaying madly, so they pulled more quickly to steady it. I suddenly remembered that I had forgotten to slide down to the V. All the time I had been standing on the skid. Unhooking my arms, I dropped to a sitting position, put my crossed legs and arms around the rope, and slid. I hit the V with a jerk that almost threatened to cut me in half. By that time, the ground was about 20 feet away. I wasted no more time but grasped the rope with my hands, and as the kite came into about 8 feet, let go and turned a somersault in a breakfall as I landed. "Young man," said the kite master, "that was a good performance. You did well to remember and reach the V. It would have cost you 2 broken legs otherwise. Now we will let some of the others try, and then you can go up again." The next one to go up, a young monk, did better than I. He remembered to slide to the V without delay, but when the poor fellow came to land, he alighted perfectly and then fell flat in his face, clutching the ground, his face a greenish tinge, and was well and truly airsick. The third monk to fly was rather cocksure, and he was not popular because of his continual boasting. He had been on the trip for 3 years past and considered himself the best airman ever. Up he went in the air, perhaps 500 feet up. Instead of sliding down to the V, he straightened up, climbed inside the box kite, missed his footing, and fell out of the tail end. One hand caught on the back cross strut, and for seconds he hung by one hand. We saw his other hand flailing vainly, trying to get a grip, and then the kite bobbed, and he lost his hold and went tumbling, end over end, down the rocks, 5,000 feet below, his robe whispering and fluttering like a blood-red cloud. The proceedings were a little dampened by this occurrence, but not enough to stop flying. The kite was hauled down and examined to see if it had sustained any damage. Then I went up again. This time I slid down to the V as soon as the kite was 100 feet in the air. Below me I could see a party of monks climbing down the mountainside to recover the body sprawled in a pulpy red mess across a rock. I looked up and thought that a man standing in the box of the kite would be able to move position and alter the lift a little. I remembered the incident of the peasant's roof and the yak dung, and how I had gained lift by pulling on the kite string. "I must discuss this with my guide," I thought. At that moment, there was a sickening sensation of falling, so fast and so unexpected that I almost let go. Down below, the monks were hauling frantically on the rope. With the approach of evening and the cooling of the rocks, the wind in the valley had become less, and the updraft from the funnel had almost stopped. There was little lift now, and as I jumped at 10 feet, the kite gave one last lurch and tipped over onto me. I sat there on the rocky ground with my head through the silk bottom of the kite box. I sat so still, so deep in thought, that the others imagined that I was injured. The llama, Mingyar Dandup, rushed across. "If we had a strut across here," I said, "we should be able to stand on it and slightly alter the angle of the box. Then we should have a little control over the lift." The kite master had heard me. "Yes, young man, you are right. But who would try it out?" "I would," I replied, "if my guide would permit me." Another llama turned to me with a smile. "You are a llama in your own right," Lobsang. "You do not have to ask anyone now." "Oh, yes, I do," was my response. "The llama Mingyar Dandup taught me all I know and is teaching me all the time, so it is for him to say." The kite master supervised the removal of the kite, then took me to his own room. Here he had small models of various kites. One was a long thing, which somehow resembled an elongated bird. We pushed the full-size one off the cliff many years ago. A man was in it. He flew for nearly 20 miles, then hit the side of a mountain. We have not done anything with this type since. Now here is a kite such as you envision. A strut across here and a holding bar there. We have one already made. The woodwork is already finished. It is in the little disused store at the far end of the block. I have not been able to get anyone to try it, and I am a little overweight. As he was about 300 pounds in weight, this was an almost classic understatement. The llama, Mingyar Dandup, had entered during the discussion. Now he said, "We will do a horoscope tonight, Lobsang, and see what the stars say about it." The booming of the drums awakened us for the midnight service. As I was taking my place, a huge figure sidled up, looming like a small mountain out of the incense cloud. It was the kite master. "Did you do it?" he whispered. "Yes," I whispered back. "I can fly it the day after tomorrow." "Good," he muttered. "It will be ready." Here in the temple, with the flickering butter lamps and the sacred figures around the walls, it was difficult to think of the foolish monk who had fallen out of his present life. If he had not been showing off, I might not have thought of trying to stand inside the kite body and to some extent control the lift. Here, inside the body of this temple, with the walls so brilliantly painted with holy pictures, we sat in the lotus style, each of us like a living statue of the Lord Buddha. Our seats were the square cushions too high, and they raised us some 10 or 12 inches above the floor. We sat in double rows, each two rows facing each other. Our normal service came first. The leader of the chants, chosen for his musical knowledge and deep voice, sang the first passages. At the end of each, his voice sank lower and lower until his lungs were emptied of air. We droned the responses, certain passages of which were marked by the beating of the drums or the ringing of our sweet-toned bells. We had to be extremely careful of our articulation, as we believe that this discipline of a lamasery can be gauged by the clarity of its singing and the accuracy of the music. Tibetan written music would be difficult for a Westerner to follow. It consists of curves. We draw the rise and fall of the voice. This is the basic curve. Those who wish to improvise add their improvements in the form of smaller curves with the large. With the ordinary service ended, we were allowed 10 minutes rest before beginning the service for the dead, for the monk who had passed from the world that day. We assembled again on the given signal. The leader, on his raised throne, intoned a passage from the Bardo Thodol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. O wandering ghost of the monk Kumphel Lala, who this day fell from the life of this world, wander not among us, for you have departed from us this day. O wandering ghost of the monk Kumphel Lala, we light this stick of incense to guide you, that you may receive instruction as to your path through the lost lands and on to the greater reality. We would chant invitations to the ghost to come and receive enlightenment and guidance. We, younger men in our high voices, and the older monks growling the responses in very deep bass tones. Monks and lamas sitting in the main body of the hall in rows, facing each other, raising and lowering religious symbols in an age-old ritual. O wandering ghost, come to us that you may be guided. You see not our faces, smell not our incense, wherefore you are dead. Come that you may be guided. The orchestra of woodwind, drums, conches, and cymbals filled in our pauses. A human skull, inverted, was filled with red water to simulate blood and was passed around for each monk to touch. Your blood has spilled upon the earth, O monk, who is but a wandering ghost. Come that you may be freed. Rice grains, dyed a bright saffron, were cast to the east, to the west, to the north, and to the south. Where does wandering ghost roam? To the east, or to the north, to the west, or to the south? Food of the gods is cast to the corners of the earth, and you eat it not. Wherefore you are dead. Come, O wandering ghost, that you may be freed and guided. The deep bass drum thrummed with the rhythm of life itself, with the ordinary deep-felt ticking of the human body. Other instruments broke in with all the sounds of the body, the faint rushing of the blood through veins and arteries, the muted whisper of breath in the lungs, the gurgling of body fluids on the move, the various creakings, squeaks, and rumbles which make the music of life itself. All the faint noises of humanity, starting off in ordinary tempo, a frightened scream from a trumpet, and the increased beat of the heart sound, a soggy thwack, and the sudden halting of noise. The end of life violently terminated. O monk that was, hanging ghost that is, our telepaths will guide you. Fear not, but lay bare your mind. Receive our teachings that we may free you. There is no death, wandering ghost. but only the life unending. Death is birth, and we call to free you for a new life. Throughout centuries, we Tibetans have developed the science of sounds. We know all the sounds of the body and can reproduce them clearly. Once heard, they are never forgotten. Have you ever laid your head upon a pillow at the verge of sleep and heard the beating of your heart, the breathing of your lungs? In the lamasery of the state oracle, they put the medium into a trance using some of these sounds, and he is entered by a spirit. The soldier, young husband, who was the head of the British forces invading Lhasa in 1904, testified to the power of these sounds and to the fact that the oracle actually changed appearance when in trance. With the ending of the service, we hurried back to our sleep. With the excitement of flying and the very different air, I was almost asleep on my feet. When the morning came, the kite master sent me a message that he would be working on the controllable kite and inviting me to join him. With my guide, I went to his workshop, which he had fitted up in the old storeroom. Piles of foreign woods littered the floor, and the walls had many diagrams of kites. The special model which I was going to use was suspended from the vaulted roof. To my astonishment, the kite master pulled on a rope, and the kite came down to floor level. It was suspended on some sort of a pulley arrangement. At his invitation, I climbed in. The floor of the box part had many struts upon which one could stand, and a crossbar at waist level afforded a satisfactory barrier to which one could cling. We examined the kite, every inch of it. The silk was removed, and the kite master said that he was going to cover it with new silk himself. The wings at the side were not straight, as with the other machine, but were curved like a cupped hand held palm down. They were about 10 feet long, and I had the impression that there would be very good lifting power. The next day, the machine was carried out into the open, and the monks had a struggle to hold it down when carrying it across the crevasse with the strong updraft of air. Finally, they placed it in position, and I, very conscious of my importance, clambered into the box. This time, monks were going to launch the kite instead of using horses, as was more usual. It was considered that monks could exercise more control. Satisfied, I called out, "Tradi tempa," or "Ready, pull." Then, as the first tremor ran through the frame, I shouted, "O Nadoal," which is goodbye. A sudden jolt, and the machine shot up like an arrow. A good thing I was hanging on thoroughly, I thought, or they would be searching for my wandering ghost tonight, and I'm quite satisfied with this body for a little longer. The monks below played with the rope, managed it skillfully, and the kite rose higher and higher. I threw out the stone with the prayer to the wind gods, and it just missed a monk far below. We were later able to use that cloth again as it fell at the monk's feet. Down below, the kite master was dancing with impatience for me to start my testing, so I thought I'd better get on with it. Cautiously moving around, I found that I could very considerably alter the performance, the lift, and the attitude of the kite. I grew careless and too confident. I moved to the back of the box, and the kite fell like a stone. My feet slipped from the bar, and I was hanging straight down by my hands at arm's length. By great efforts, with my robe whipping and flapping around my head, I managed to draw myself up and climb to the normal position. The fall stopped, and the kite surged upwards. By then, I had got my head free of my robe, and I looked out. If I had not been a shaven-headed llama, my hair would have stood straight on end. I was less than 200 feet above the ground. Later, when I landed, they said I had come to 50 feet before the kite's fall was checked and it rose again. For a time, I clung to the bar, panting and gasping with the exertion in the thin air. As I looked about over the miles and miles of countryside, I saw in the far distance something that looked like a dotted line moving along. For a moment I stared uncomprehendingly, then it dawned upon me. Of course, it was the rest of the herb-gathering party making their slow way across the desolate country. They were strung out, big dots, little dots, and long dots. Men, boys, and animals, I thought. So slowly they moved, so painfully hesitant their progress. It gave me much pleasure, upon landing, to say that the party would be with us within a day or so. It was truly fascinating to look about over the cold blue-gray of the rocks and the warm red ochre of the earth, and see lakes shimmering in the far distance. Down below, in the ravine, where it was warmed and sheltered from the bitter winds, mosses, lichens, and plants made a carpet work which reminded me of that in my father's study. Across it ran the little stream which sang to me in the night. Ran across it, yes, and that too reminded me painfully of the time when I upset a jar of clear water over father's carpet. Yes, my father certainly had a very heavy hand. The country at the back of the lamasery was mountainous, peak after peak rising in their serried ranks until, against the far distant skyline, they stood outlined blackly against the sunlight. The sky in Tibet is the clearest in the world. One can see as far as the mountains will permit, and there are no heat hazes to cause distortion. So far as I could see, nothing moved in the whole vast distance except the monks below me, and those scarce recognizable dots toiling interminably towards us. Perhaps they could see me here. But now the kite began to jerk. The monks were hauling me down. With infinite care, they pulled so as to avoid damaging the valuable experimental machine. On the ground, the kite master looked on me with fond affection and put his mighty arms around my shoulders with such enthusiasm that I was sure that every bone was crushed. No one else could get a word in. For years he had had theories but could not put them to the test. His immense bulk made it impossible for him to fly. As I kept telling him, when he paused for breath, I liked doing it. I got as much pleasure out of flying as he did from designing, experimenting, and watching. Yes, yes, Lobsang, now, if we just move this over here and put that strut there, Yes, that will do it. We will take it in and start on it now. And it rocked sideways, you say, when you did this? So it went on. Fly and alter, fly and alter. And I loved every second of it. No one but I was allowed to fly or even set foot in that special kite. Each time I used it, there were some modifications, some improvements. The biggest improvement, I thought, was the strap to hold me in. But the arrival of the rest of the party put a stop to kite flying for a day or two. We had to organize the newcomers into gathering and packing groups. The less experienced monks were to gather three kinds of plants only, and they were sent to areas where such plants were plentiful. Every group stayed away for 7 days, ranging from the sources of supply. On the eighth day, they returned with the plants, which were spread out on the clean floor of a huge storage room. Very experienced lamas examined every plant to make sure that it was free from blight and of the right type. Some plants had the petals removed and dried. Others had the roots grated and stored. Yet others, as soon as they were brought in, were crushed between rollers for the juice. This fluid was stored in tightly sealed jars. Seeds, leaves, stems, petals, all were cleaned and packed in leather bags when quite dry. The bags would have the contents noted on the outside. The neck would be twisted to make it watertight, and the leather would be quickly dipped in water and exposed to the strong sunlight. Within a day, the leather would have dried as hard as a piece of wood. So hard would a bag become that to open it, the tightly twisted end would have to be knocked off. In the dry air of Tibet, herbs stored in this way would keep for years. After the first few days, I divided my time between herb gathering and kite flying. The old kite master was a man of much influence, and as he said, in view of the predictions concerning my future, knowledge of machines in the sky were as important as the ability to gather herbs and classify them. For 3 days a week, I flew in the kites. The rest of the time was spent in riding from group to group so that I could learn as much as possible in the shortest time. Often, high above, in a kite, I would look out over the now familiar landscape and see the black yak-hide tents of the herb gatherers. Around them, the yaks would be grazing, making up for lost time, the time at the end of the week when they would have to carry in the load of herbs. Many of these plants were quite well known in most eastern countries, but others had not been discovered by the Western world, and so had no Latin names. A knowledge of herbs has been of great use to me, but the knowledge of flying was no less so. We had one more accident. A monk had been watching me rather closely, and when it was his turn to fly in an ordinary kite, thought that he could do as well as I. High in the air, the kite seemed to be acting strangely. We saw that the monk was flinging himself about in an attempt to control the position of the machine. One specially rough lurch, and the kite dipped and tilted sideways. There was a ripping and splintering of wood, and the monk came tumbling out of the side. As he fell, he spun head over feet with his robe whirling over his head. A rain of articles fell down, Sampa bowl, wooden cup, rosary, and various charms. He would no longer need them. Spinning end over end, he finally disappeared in the ravine. Later came the sound of the impact. All good things come too quickly to an end. The days were full of work, hard work, but all too soon our 3 months' visit drew to a close. This was the first of a number of pleasant visits to the hills and to the other Tra Yelpa nearer Lhasa. Reluctantly, we packed our few belongings. I was given a beautiful model man-lifting kite by the kite master, which he had made specially for me. On the next day, we set off for home. A few of us, on arriving, did a forced ride, and the main body of monks, acolytes, and pack animals followed on in leisurely manner. We were glad to be back at the Iron Mountain, but sorry indeed to be parted from our new friends and the great freedom of the hills. End of chapter 12.